welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
Okay, we are at minute 109, and poor Peggy, it looks like she's going to wreck her mascara if she was wearing mascara. But Hal, bring us up to the end of the war here.
All right. Jump on the train for VE Day. In the Hydra base control room, Peggy Carter sits at the radio console, tears streaming down her face as she stares at the silent receiver. "Steve," she whispers, her voice breaking. Colonel Phillips, his expression heavy, turns and walks away. The scene dissolves to the Arctic Sea at sunset, where the massive Valkyrie sinks beneath the ice, its dark form swallowed by the frozen expanse. The view shifts to VE Day in London's Trafalgar Square. A mix of U.S. and British aircraft, including a P-51 Mustang, a Spitfire, a Hurricane, a Lancaster, and a B-17 roar overhead, their wings glinting in the sunlight. Below, men and women embrace in a jubilant crowd, triumphant music swelling as the war in Europe ends in victory.
And we do get the very last second of this. We see the Howland Commandos getting together, but we're going to save that for 110.
There we go. Yeah. Got to save something for 110.
What a neat sequence of sacrifice and triumph, you know, which is really kind of what the whole war was about, wasn't it? A lot of people died so we could have this celebration.
Absolutely. And as well as this captures what that mood and feeling must have been like. I mean, you think about anything, you know, any of us have ever faced in our lives, and just those things that you say, if you ever catch yourself saying, whatever this particular crisis in my life I'm going through, I'm just kind of imagining, I can't wait for that moment that it's over, that sense of profound relief. But then trying to imagine, what does that feel like when it's most of the world feeling that exact same way at that exact same time, to be in the middle of a crowd like that. I'm not a big lover of crowds, but I just can't, I have to imagine that atmosphere was just indescribable.
Yeah, I would think there'd be a lot of different emotions coming through. I mean, you see it all end and you remember, like, you know, oh, we did it. We finally did all this. But then I think after you start processing, you think of what was lost, what went behind you and stuff. Yeah. I was just looking at a book by General Gavin, who was in charge of the 82nd Airborne Division. He wrote a book called On to Berlin. So let me give you a quote. He said, "So we had come to the end of the war in Europe. It had been costly. More than 60,000 men had passed through the ranks of the 82nd Airborne Division alone. We had left in our wake thousands of white crosses from Africa to Berlin. And when it came to an end, there was not a man in the ranks of the 82nd Airborne Division who did not believe that it was a war that had to be fought. It was something that really, it's something that they had to get through."
Right. Something they had to get through. And that's profound, because we're, you know, from that quote, you get that sort of bit of that hooray, it's over, but dear God, at what cost?
Yeah.
But it was worth it. You know, you get that whole set of sentiments there, that idea that this is the absolutely horrific cost, but it had to be paid.
Yeah. You know, years ago, my family and I went to London, and it must have been 2009. My wife and I went to London and visited these spots that are depicted in this movie, you know, Trafalgar Square, and walked up toward Buckingham Palace and so forth. And it was just so easy and to imagine being there at this time and just looking around at this peaceful spot and feeling, you still feel it in the air, just because, probably because I've seen so many, you know, newsreel footages and movies and depictions of this event. But that was the first thing on my mind as I was walking around London in these areas, was, my God, what would it have been like to be there on VE Day?
Right.
Yeah, and you know, and the news spread so fast at the end. I mean, by May of 1945, everybody was pretty much assured that the war was about to be over. They didn't know how fast it was going to happen, but suddenly it's over and you've got hundreds of thousands of troops that have to get home.
Yeah,
And
right.
now it's just the
Well,
waiting. My
yeah.
dad was in Belgium the day the war ended, and he didn't get home until September of that year.
Wow. Well, and speaking of September, though, you also had this, you have this triumphant, the celebration, the X-wings dropping fireworks over Coruscant, that kind of thing happening. But we have to keep our momentum up because it's not over in the Pacific.
Right.
And that would have to be so hard to exhale and say, thank God it's over and hooray, we won. And starting to come to grips with all that. And then that reminder, hang on, we're not quite there yet. You go, well, just in terms of wherewithal and resolve, we have to push on until it's, over there too. It was over here, now it's gonna be over there.
And the other thing that the troops were looking at in Europe was saying, well, this part's over, but am I going to get shipped to the Pacific? What, you know?
Right.
Yeah, that was a huge question for so many people, and soldiers and air crew and everything else. And there was certainly a subset of people who were, if nothing else, Patton, wondering if we need to now move east and and strike things up with the Soviets. And he just, my gosh, who knows how the world would have changed had that happened.
It's difficult. Now, I do have questions doing what ifs on stuff. The as we're watching those Lancasters and B-17s and Spitfires and stuff, of all those aircraft, the only one really that was used in the Pacific was the 51. I don't know if B-17s were ever deployed in the Pacific. I don't think the Army had much of a presence there, so.
There wasn't much, but they were there. I mean, remember there were B-17s at Pearl Harbor. So that was certainly the case, and there were Spitfires in the Pacific to a degree. Yeah, of those, I guess I can't tell you for sure off the top of my head about the Hurricanes. I'm quite certain the Lancasters wouldn't have. I don't recall ever hearing about the British sending strategic bombers that far afield.
I mean, they really wouldn't have, I mean, at least with the B-17s or the Lancaster, they wouldn't have the range required that, things like a B-29
Right.
could pull for heading for the Japanese mainland. So
Right.
a
And
lot of
that
these, a lot of
is,
these were just going to get retired.
yeah. And the Pacific theater is so spread out with, I mean, they named it after an ocean after all. So there's,
That's true.
the bits of land are sort of few and far between.
Just for, our conversation's sake, I just looked up the aircraft flown aboard the USS Hornet, which we discussed recently in 1945, and they had Grumman F6F Hellcats. They had Vought F4U Corsairs, Curtiss SB2C Helldivers, and Grumman TBF-TBM Avengers torpedo bombers. So they had a bunch of dive bombers, torpedo bombers, fighter and ground attack aircraft. That's what was going off of an aircraft carrier
Well,
back
yeah,
then. But
and
of course,
of
they had
course,
some.
and before that was, Doolittle with the 25s that were the bombers that were the first attack on Tokyo.
Right. Yeah, that would have been sort of the first sort of army presence, Army Air Corps, or later Army Air Force's presence in the Pacific. And just if anybody wonders why, when we talk about the Grumman Avenger in particular, like TBF slash TBM, those designations change based on the manufacturer. So it's a Grumman design. If it was built by Grumman, it's a TBF, F being the code for Grumman, obviously. And M meant they were the ones built under license by General Motors. I'm not sure about the Hellcats. So the F6F Hellcats, another Grumman design. The Wildcats, we know it as the F4F, but actually all but one of the surviving restored flying Wildcats today, earlier counterpart to the Hellcat, the predecessor. All but one of those that fly today are actually FM2s, the M being for General Motors.
Are there any existing buffaloes?
Not flyable, the Brewster Buffaloes. I know there's maybe a small handful in museums here or there, but nothing that flies. Interestingly, just in the last basically not much more than a year, the population of helldivers, like Brian mentioned, the SP2C, the population of flying helldivers has tripled,
Wow.
which is really unusual. We there was one forever. Most of, most of at least our adult lives. I use the word adult in air quotes, but then two restorations were finished like early last summer, and that's exciting to see because that's, a lot of this stuff doesn't move in that direction, but when it does, that's really, really cool.
I used to live not too far from the plant in Warminster, Pennsylvania, where they made the Brewster Buffalo,
Oh, gotcha.
or they didn't make the Brewster Buffalo. It was a really weird thing at the beginning of the war when they were building these. And from what I understood, the Buffalo was kind of an underpowered fighter, all-purpose ship. And the problem that they had was the factory. Workers were going on strike, and they were told they couldn't go on strike because there's a war on. So what they did was they just kind of dragged their heels making them, and eventually the contract was given up because, well, it was an underpowered fighter, but it was just too much trouble to get people in the factory to make the plane. So they just kind of gave up on it.
Now, that's interesting. I've never heard that particular piece of it. It was one of those that was, that was early enough that the timing was wrong. It was already on its way to obsolescence at the start of the war, and for a small fighter that couldn't carry much, it was fairly heavy. Even with a 1200 horsepower radial engine, it was still, as you say, it was kind of underpowered. I just was also looking. I was curious about survivors. There's a crashed example in a Finnish museum. There's let's see, and then maybe another one at another Finnish museum. The Finns seem to be pretty
Probably
Finns seem to like it.
digging them out of glaciers or something.
Right, and then there was a replica in the Netherlands, and then a static full-scale replica at a museum I believe we were just talking about, Jim, the Cradle of Aviation,
Yeah, up in Garden City, Long Island.
and Long Island.
Yeah. Long
So
Island.
yeah, but yeah, certainly not a common airplane. One of the ones we keep waiting for would be a predecessor of sorts to the Helldiver, and that would be the Devastator. As we know, where there are plenty at the bottom of at least the ocean, if not one or two in the Great Lakes, but there is not a single example of those anywhere on land, anywhere in the world, in any museum. And so, there's always that hope that one of these days, one of these sort of well-heeled warbird people will go after one. And I mean, at least to get one restored to static display, would be remarkable.
Getting back to the movie aircraft, looking at that flying wing where it kind of bumped into the ice floe, but it seems to be pretty much in one piece. The cockpit is not under the ice, so
Not yet, but there.
did Captain America bump his head or something? I'm just wondering what's going on
Yeah,
inside there.
I think he's
Oh yeah.
unconscious because yeah, it's
Sure.
largely in one piece, but there's a lot of debris and some pretty big pieces of debris that we pan over before we get to the airplane. So it had a rough landing. And
Yeah, I take it he's out cold and about to get colder. But as the aircraft is, it's melting into the ice. It's going down, and it's going to seal itself around him, and he will be fresh and vacuum packed in about a few minutes here.
Sure,
But
there's an
yeah, you could.
infomercial here somewhere.
But boy, there's just some beautiful cinematography here, or fake cinematography of the sun setting on the wreck of the flying wing, and you can still see its engines glowing orange in the orange of the sunlight and the blue of the ice. And by golly, it's pretty. It's I'm going to keep calling it out, blue and orange. It's a wonderful color palette. And then we cut, we have cut from that, cut to that from the blue of Hydra headquarters. Of Peggy and Colonel Phillips, and it's just it's so thoughtfully done and artfully done that I can just kind of stand back and tip my cap to the people who made this minute of the movie.
Right. And that transition from the aircraft sinking as the sun just sort of flares. It's like we're looking at the sun, it's getting brighter and brighter, and then we're completely washed out and then
Yep, goes white.
dissolve perfectly to Trafalgar Square, and the airplane's going over. And
Well, it's interesting too because the Trafalgar Square in the sky there is blue and cloudy, but it's like a warm blue, whereas the ice is like a cold blue, and it's what a neat palette.
Yeah,
So somebody thought of that.
and that view, I mean, we're hearing another variation on the cap theme, Alan Silvestri's cap theme, with the baritones, the French horns, trombones, all coming up, the low brass playing as the victorious allies fly overhead. It's quietly triumphant. It isn't blaring at you. It's like this is
Right.
kind of showing you time is passing, but it's also, here's what happened thanks to, Cap's work.
Sure.
Yep.
You know, something I was just wondering about looking at that scene, and as Brian's pointing out, savoring the palate, there's so much warmth in the crowd and the buildings and everything. There's just a hint of sort of a sepia cast, but the Union flags that they're waving give it a splash of color. The blue sky and white clouds is colorful, but it is on the warmer side. As I was looking at that, and I see somebody holding the newspaper with a VE Day headline, and I'm wondering about the timing of that, because I think the news would have broken by radio, and I would think everybody's out there celebrating, and we know we had multiple editions of newspapers back then, and of course stop the presses, and this is a rush edition, and extra read all about it, all of those good things. But I do wonder how quickly would somebody in this crowd, either how long were they celebrating, or how quickly would they have had a newspaper with that headline in it?
Well, I mean, yeah, like you said, they were doing like triple and quadruple editions every day. They were coming out hourly, especially kind of a tabloid like the Mirror, which is the one that's it's publishing
Is that
this.
what
I'm
it
sure,
is, the mirror?
yeah, the Mirror. I'm sure
Oh,
they
yeah.
must have had like five or six editions as they're hearing
Yeah.
from.
That is, by the way, a nice facsimile of the true cover of the Daily Mirror on VE Day. It looks just
Oh,
like that.
terrific.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's
Great.
it
But
just
I'm with
it.
Jim. They would have had probably, three or four or five editions that day of, sending the kids out on the corner with a brand new
Yeah.
printing.
Yeah, if I remember, it was I think it was Raymond Chandler wrote a he wrote a suspense novel or a short story about a fellow who's following who winds up following a murderer. There was a guy who killed his wife early in the morning, and he was reading about the story on a streetcar. And he read the story about this guy that had like a scar on his arm and a scar on his face. And as he's sitting in the streetcar, he notices a guy with a bandage around his face, and the guy has like blood on his arm. And so he watches him get off at a certain stop. And so as he thinks nothing of it because he's like, oh, what a coincidence. And then he reads the Midday edition, and it seems like the guy has escaped. He killed a police officer, and he's somewhere in the Central District. And the guy keeps like reading newspapers and finding out. And then on his way home from work, he sees the same guy, and he realizes the guy knows that he knows. And then they capture him. And of course, it ends with the following day that this local hero captures this guy from our newspaper.
What a great story.
Yeah, what a great idea to.
I wish I
I
knew
am
the
reminded of
title of
one
that
of my
article.
pet peeves as a cartoonist, and that is that almost every movie or TV show that's ever showed a cartoonist working shows them drawing something in the morning and it appearing in the paper that afternoon. And that might be true. That's definitely true for an editorial cartoonist who would often have a 1 or 2 hour deadline to turn around their take on the day's events. But a syndicated cartoonist, your Dick Tracys and your Little Orphan Annies, those cartoonists work months in advance, and they wouldn't have had time to plant clues to murderers or do any of the other things that movies showed cartoonists doing. It's one of the fictions that just as doctors don't like movies about doctors, and police don't like shows about police, and I don't
Yeah.
like movies about cartoonists because they never get it right.
Yeah.
What was the Leah Thompson? Was it Leah Thompson? Was it Caroline in the City?
Caroline in the City.
She was doing kind of a
It was like Kathy. She was doing a Kathy Geisweit cartoon.
Thank you. I remember it was very much a kind of a Kathy takeoff. I'd forgotten about
Yeah.
that show.
Yeah, it was a good show, and I like Leah Thompson very much, but its take on cartooning was not realistic. Sad to say.
Are there any good
Here are three guys who
cartoonists?
are fun to go to movies with. I just want to point that out.
I always think of My World and Welcome to It, which pretty much covers Thurber's short stories, and he was a cartoonist as well as an author. But I didn't know, have you seen a realistic cartoonist movie or TV show?
Well, that's a fair question. Probably not, and I don't really care. It's just a minor irritant. I'm trying to think if I've ever seen a depiction of an editorial cartoonist, because that would have been the kind of go, 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 talk about the day's events and, solve a murder kind of job. I can't think of one. No.
I would say if we're talking
Well, in comic books too, by the way, I got to throw that in there. Comic books,
sure.
people think comic books are drawn and published and printed the day after, Jack Kirby or
Right.
Bert Swan put the ink on the paper. And again, no, months in advance.
Now I will die on a hill that the most realistic depiction of animated cartooning would be Duck Amuck
Oh,
with
yeah.
Chuck Jones and the characters coming to life right in front of him and reacting in things and
Oh,
Daffy
yeah.
getting his bill erased so he can't talk anymore.
No, that's just a documentary. Yeah.
Yeah, that's all that was. I believe that to be
Yeah.
forever true. That is the reason why I one day plan to have a flag made that just has the Phillips screw and the baseball next to it. When Daffy's they gives him that weird body and he's towing this screwball flag.
Screwball, yeah.
That will never not be funny to me. I mean, it was funny 40 years before I was around, or 30 years
Yeah.
before I was born. And
So, Jim, it occurs to me you were talking earlier about, the what ifs of history. And one would think that if we had really had Captain America fighting World War II for us, VE Day would have come sooner than it did in real life. But on the other hand, we didn't have a Hydra. So I'm kind of looking at Captain America's influence and Hydra's influence as kind of a wash,
And that's a common, I think I've seen it in most of the Superman TV shows where Superman gets blamed that all these super villains come to our planet because we have a Kryptonian living among us. So it's like if we didn't have Captain America, maybe we wouldn't have super villains doing bad things on our world.
It's a little cynical.
Yeah,
But it's like
exactly.
I'm pretty sure it was in Lois and Clark, and I'm pretty sure it was also in Smallville.
No, you're right.
Not in
It's a
Smallville,
trope
and
that comes up once in a while, and I think
yeah.
that kind of analysis is comes from people who've gotten too old to be reading comic books.
Yeah.
When you're asking questions like that, it's time to give up Superman and Batman. And
I mean, I think you've seen that in almost every iteration, film or TV iteration of Superman. That's a
yeah.
very common trope and something. Whenever we pass that point where I think you nailed it, Brian. People growing up, they're too old to be, too old to be doing this. But not the darkness that we saw from Frank Miller when in changing things with Batman, but that. Let's start asking more plausible and grounded questions. The first time we see somebody talking about, Superman and the bad guy duking out, who's going to pay for all these buildings that got demolished, and that sort of thinking that kind of.
No, I have to say I do enjoy Damage Control. Not
I like
the
damage control.
movie. I don't like the movie version of Damage Control. It's too negative. Damage Control to me was like the natural, the two Marvel the two Marvel series that I enjoy are Damage Control and not Brand X. And to me,
Because they're pretty meta, but yeah, I get it.
And
I get it.
Forbush Man needs to be part of the MCU. I don't know how they're going to put him in there, but he needs to show up. And I'm sorry if I'm going too esoteric, but I'm hoping that our astute audience will know what I'm talking about.
You may be because I'm not familiar with either of those.
Oh, not Brand
Oh,
X. Oh my gosh.
no.
I've
Well, it's old.
yeah,
It's older than you, Hal.
it's older than you.
Ah,
It's from the
okay.
60s. And Hal, imagine if Laugh-In, which I
Yeah.
think you've seen reruns of.
Oh
Imagine
my
if
gosh.
La
I saw some of that live as a little
yeah,
kid.
well,
I
imagine
found it awkward and embarrassing, but yes.
if Laugh-In were
Did
a
not hold
comic
up.
strip. And
Okay.
Forbush Man is a guy who you never see his face. That's one of the things that you never see his face. You see the back of his head, and
Okay.
he winds up with becoming a superhero, but he wears basically a union suit. He's got big red long johns on, and he wears a pot over his head with two eyeballs. So all you ever see is the pot on his head and two eyeballs with the handle sticking out to the side. And Irving Forbush was his name, Irving Forbush, and he became Forbush
Forbush
Man.
man.
And he had a giant F on his shirt, white shirt. Kind of like if I don't know if you ever had a chance to see either Captain Nice or Mr. Terrific. Both of those,
Mr. Terrific, I'm familiar
yeah,
with, yeah.
both of those shows had the same format. But it's or you, the other way to put it is Mad Magazine specified down to the Marvel Universe.
And a
There
little
we
dumber
go.
than Mad Magazine, frankly,
Oh
but
yeah.
in the
It's
same spirit.
it
Same
was built
spirit.
for people like me. It was built for
For whom Mad was too smart.
I'll check it out. You guys don't have to sell it so hard. You had me at a sideways pot on the
Oh,
guy. Yeah, that
they
sounds
had
top drawer.
one where they centerfold was inside and you open it up and it was Sue Storm. So it was a big white piece of paper. And so see, I think I've dragged Hal
That's
into it.
yeah.
He's
I mean,
getting
that's the same gag is every year on April Fool's Day, the Smithsonian or some air show or some other museum shows, Wonder
Oh,
Woman's jet on
yeah.
display. And it's sometimes it's just three little faint tire impressions in
Yeah.
grass,
Or the chalks or something,
or
you
the
know? Yeah.
chalks. Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Speaking again, I gotta bring up the comic books. People have asked, and again, I think this is a big mistake. Well, if we had Superman during World War II, why didn't Superman just win the war? Why didn't he just go pick up Hitler and bring him to the Hague or something? And they actually came. Grown adults came up with a reason for this called the Spear of Destiny
Spear
that
of Destiny, yeah.
Hitler had and cast a magic spell over the Axis so that Superman couldn't penetrate it. And it's just like, how wearisome is that? What a,
Yes.
what,
Well, Superman can
why?
Superman cannot defeat magic. That's one of the basic things. That's what,
But again, if
Mr.
you got to
Mistletoe
ask why
can't.
Superman didn't just win World War II instantly, put down the comic books and
Yeah.
walk away gently.
Just to walk away. Yeah, I mean, even Superman is still just one person. I mean, yeah, in theory he could have like flown in and gotten Hitler, but okay, you drag Hitler out of there. That doesn't just mean
Yeah,
everybody else just wakes up from their spell. Oh
everybody
my
moves
gosh, I
up
was a
one.
Nazi? What, it's not like that just stops. It would still take,
Well, he could take
a
out a
lot of
lot of
tune-up.
tanks, he could take out a lot of planes. Superman could do some damage.
He could do some real damage, but it wouldn't be, he wouldn't just snap his fingers and make it instantly over.
Depends how loud he snapped them. Yeah.
Well, there is that. Or if what if Thanos snapped his fingers? We know how that turns out.
Al, you have to stop picking at her, it's gonna get infected.
Fair enough. Hey, so I do have one other question, and maybe this is something, maybe it'll make it rhetorical because we will have stuff. This might be better for later minutes, but I wonder if there was ever any point when we're Joe and company are breaking down the story for this film and figuring out the arc. You think that anybody involved would have ever considered basically ending the film here at this minute, and then Cap's unfreezing and recovery comes in some other film later?
It doesn't give you a release. I don't think there's enough of a
Right.
resolution to you there.
But it sure makes you want to
Yeah.
see the next one.
Yeah. It's
Didn't Joe say
Yeah, I'm not saying I'm in favor of it at all. It just was just a thought
when we
that.
had Joe on as a guest, he said that he was the one who really pushed to have as much World War II content as we did, correct? Do I
Yeah,
remember that right?
that's
Yes,
true.
that's
Yeah.
right. Yeah, he
To
wanted to
make
get
the film a World War II film with
Marvel's
a
original
coda.
vision was we spent a little time flashback in World War II, and then we got
Yeah.
Captain America in the the 2000s. But so it was Joe himself who said, "No, this is going to be a World War II movie."
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I doubt it because I'm with Jim. There's no up if you just leave Captain America frozen in the ice. He's got to
Right.
come out of it.
Yeah, there's a prank video that's you can see on YouTube a lot where one of the toy stores, I think it was Toy Story 3, there's a scene in Toy Story 3 where all that they're the toys are all being fed into a furnace and they reach out and
Yes.
hold each other's hands And what people are doing is they edit the film so, like, as the flames are rising higher and higher, it fades out, and then it says directed by Brad Bird. And it's like they're
That's
showing,
so
people are showing this to
horrible.
their mom, and they're like, this is terrible. You know, so it's like
That's
that's
not
the,
what happened.
yeah, that's the feeling that you'd get if you walked out. It's like, oh, the plane crashed, and I guess he's dead. Yeah, it doesn't quite work.
I mean, you could have conceivably ended it with it's over, and then there's a mid-credit scene, or the very last scene is, we see a little, we go to Cap entombed under this thing, and we see a twitch or his chest rise or
Yeah,
something. But
big frozen hand coming up out of the
yeah,
ice
and
like
I mean,
Deliverance.
I absolutely agree. I don't think that would have been the right way to do it. I just got thinking, I wonder if there was somebody somewhere along the way who'd considered that, but obviously Joe's vision was clear and direct.
Yeah, I really I think it's a great question. I doubt it. It also doesn't it doesn't give you the joy we were talking about of, the up, but it also doesn't give you it doesn't complete the tragedy of the man lost in time. It's a sadder story if we see him wake up 70 years later than it would be if he just went in the ice. We didn't know what happened to him.
That's a great point, because as I was asking the question, I'm thinking about ending on this super downer note, but it's still not the happiest of endings, even as it turns out,
Oh,
because
it's a
of,
bummer.
it's not just hooray, I'm alive. It's like, I'm alive and I don't, where is everybody? And I'm sad and alone.
Well, they'll figure out a sequel to it somehow in the present day. Which, I mean, and the thing that I keep thinking about in setting this up as a man out of time is that they have to try not making it look like Austin Powers. So it's
Yeah, they had that to deal with. That's right.
yeah. So it's trying. And there is a certain element of humor in here, but trying to tell this straight after Austin Powers is a difficult. That's a difficult task.
Oh, they succeeded, I think.
Yeah.
That's a good topic for another show, is what are the what are the movies that came along and sort of ruined a trope for other films, or made that a big challenge. But a topic for another day.
Yes. Wow. Well, I'm sure there's other people who want to talk about this, but why don't we let them continue the conversation over at our big web, well, not our web presence, our social media presence, Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base over on Facebook. And if you do like the show, please don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. We don't charge anything for the show, but if we do ask if you could do likes and subscribes wherever you're getting the show, it always helps us. Also, please check out our great big website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.